Blog Talk Radio.
At you from the Fraser Valley. This is Left of the Valley with Kevin and Karen. Hi, Karen.
Hello.
How are you doing today?
I'm great. How are you?
Well, you know, still here, still live, can't complain. Even if I did, who would listen? But hopefully you guys are listening right now.
And we have with us today two very special guests, so we're very happy to have them here.
Absolutely. We have a great show today for you guys. The title of the show is A Skeptical Look at Martial Arts. And let's bring these people in. We got... You go ahead, do the honors.
Well, first we have Charles Ahrens, who teaches, he's a sensei for Aikido at Aikido Takayama, which is a non-profit group here in Mission. Hello, Charles.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thank you. Happy to have you here. And we also have Chris Taylor. That's right. Wait, I'm not getting your name wrong. Sudden have a panic. And he teaches, he's a sensei for ninjutsu. He teaches in Abbotsford, and we're happy to have you here, too.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here.
Awesome. Well, before we get into our subject, which is, like I said, a skeptical look at martial arts, we got a few little house cleaning to do, and let's get into that. Local news? You want to talk quick, really briefly about local news? It seems that in Mission, Randy Hawes, the ex-MLA, is going to run again for mayor.
Yes, he's certainly... he hasn't committed definitely, as far as I know, but he's certainly making noises, but he will.
Abbotsford apparently just went to court again to fight against the homeless. So, but we'll deal with that some other time. But we do have something interesting. Yeah.
We got mail?
We got mail. Actually, we receive thousands and thousands of letters all the time.
Right.
But actually, we thought...
Of course we got mail.
Yeah, of course. Of course. But this one I thought was really nice, and I thought I'd want to share that with the people real quick. It's actually from our friends, the group Natural Selection, that came by a couple of weeks ago. And they sent us an email, and they say, thank you so much for the opportunity... by the podcast Left at the Valley to record a session with us, a Natural Selection. This podcast addresses pertinent issues affecting the real world. We look forward to each new podcast, listening to your interesting facts and issues. Are we sure she's listening to the same podcast we are?
Of course.
It was an absolutely amazing time. You made it so much fun and yet incredibly informative and relaxed. We would not hesitate and would welcome the opportunity to record with you again.
Aww.
Isn't that
That's
nice?
That's very nice.
That's very nice.
Thank you.
And you guys also can send us an email, your love mail, your hate mail, leftatthevalley@outlook.com. leftatvalley@outlook.com. But let's get back to on track here, and you get your This Day in History segment.
Okay, well, This Day in History on June 24th, 1509. Henry VIII was crowned King of England. June 25th, 1997, Jacques Cousteau died. I always feel like he didn't live, that he lived much longer ago than that, but he didn't. 1997. 2009, Michael Jackson died. June 26, 1819, the bicycle is patented by W.K. Clarkson.
Oh, by the way, gentlemen, feel free to jump in, too. If you want to add something to what Karen is saying, don't be shy. We don't bite. Only upon request.
June 26, 1959, the St. Lawrence Seaway connecting the Great Lakes to the Atlantic is opened. Well, that's pretty cool Canadian history. June 26, 1976, the CN Tower opens. And in June 26, 2000, the human genome map is completed.
I was there when they built the CN Tower.
Really?
Yeah.
That's cool.
In Toronto?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Huh. June 28th, 1914, Archduke Ferdinand of Austria-Hungary is assassinated, starting the First World War, the Great War. And June 28th, 1919, the Treaty of Versailles is signed in France, ending the Great War. July 1st, 1867. Anyone know what happened on July 1st, 1867?
147 years old, is that where we are?
Yeah.
Right
there. Somewhere around there.
Canada becomes a self-governing dominion under the British North America Act. July 1st, 1968, the U.S., Britain, and the Soviet Union, and...
I can't read your writing.
I know this, but I still can't read it. Signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, 1968. July 2nd, 1566. Now, this is the most important fact of the day. Nostradamus died.
He didn't see that coming.
How do you know? July 2nd, 1937. Amelia Earhart disappears over the Pacific.
Actually, you know what? It's kind of funny because there is an urban myth that Nostradamus did predict his own death. And something about if you drink out of his skull, you inherit his prophetic powers. But if you believe that kind of stuff.
Where's his skull?
Somewhere in his grave, I would assume.
You'd give him, you'd know where it is, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Speaking of Amelia Earhart, there is a young woman in her early 30s whose name is Amelia Earhart. And she's going to attempt the same flight that the original did.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Cool.
That is very cool.
Is she Canadian or American?
She's American.
Wow. That's awesome. I'm going to have to look into that.
When is this supposed to happen?
I don't know. I just ran across it several days ago. She's using a modern Cherokee or Piper or whatever. But, you know, she has navigational stuff. But she's going to try it.
Wow.
Wow. That's
good for her.
Yeah. July 3rd, 1608, Samuel de Champlain founded Quebec City.
My hometown.
Yay! July 4th, 1776, the United States declares independence. July 4th, 1884, the Statue of Liberty is presented to the U.S. in Paris, a gift from the French. And July 4th, 2012, this is very recent history, the Higgs boson particle is discovered.
Yes, also... named by some people the God Particle, but there's a debate apparently on that.
July 5th, 1996, the first clone sheep, Dolly, is born. I remember that very well. And July 6th, 1885, Louis Pasteur successfully treats a patient with a rabies vaccine. That's mm-hmm. cool. And last one, July 6th, 1997, the Mars rover Sojourner rolls on the Martian surface.
Yes.
The spaceship on Mars.
All right, and that was it for our segment.
Yes, that's it.
All right, thank you. Join us next... No, I'm just kidding. Let's get into our what we're really here for. We're taking a skeptical look at martial arts. Everybody was kung fu. All right, gentlemen. Would you be so kind to introduce yourself with a quick... Reader's
yes.
Digest synopsis of who you are, how you came here, and how come you're down here in the dungeon with us today.
What brought you to martial arts, and you know what do you love about it?
No fighting over this. You can each go one at a time.
Chris, why don't you go first?
Go ahead, Chris.
Okay. Well, my name is Chris Taylor. I'm 47 years old, and I started training in the martial arts probably about the time I was 9 or 10. Started with judo, which I became a little unenamored with fairly quickly after hitting the mat. All day long, and it seemed to be a little tiring, giving me headaches, so I quit. And a few years later, I read a dime store novel, and it had ninja in it, and I thought that was the coolest thing ever. So I started looking into this thing, and another day I found a book about ninjutsu in another bookstore. And so I started getting a little more intrigued, and so there was actually a group of people that apparently knew more about this. So I wrote to them and got a little more involved. And so that's how it started. I was about 15 or 16 at that time. And there became a little club in Ottawa where I was living at the time. And after a few years, the Grand Master, who existed in Japan, said that he really didn't want to call this ninjutsu anymore. Although it was ninjutsu at its core, he really didn't like what was happening to his art and the kind of people he saw getting involved with it. It was a pretty crazy time in the mid-80s. So he changed it to Bujinkan Budo Taijutsu, which he thought more encompassed the feeling what he was trying to get across. And there's certainly still ninjutsu in it, but it's not, you know, putting on black masks and running around in the dark. It's more about playing with people's perceptions when you're in combat. So it's sort of the sneaky stuff that's in the fighting. It's not necessarily all pinchy stuff and things, but just giving people ideas about what's happening that are completely incorrect so you can defeat them, or at least not necessarily defeat them, but walk away yourself and be alive the next day.
So you're not going to kill us here?
You won't know, will you? No, you're pretty safe.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Yeah, interesting.
Sorry, did I interrupt your...
No, I don't know. I think like many, you know, as a young kid, I had my episodes with bullies and stuff, but that's certainly not why I stayed in martial arts. I think the relationships you build with other people, the fascinating people that you meet, you know, in your own clubs. I travel to Japan every couple of years, try and get some training there, meet people from all over the world, and I think you just an amazing cross-section of people. They're certainly interesting people drawn to martial arts. They're not your average Joe, for sure, but you meet some very fascinating people, and that's certainly what's kept me so intrigued in this. And, you know, it's good for trying to learn things, and you see people are so much better than you, you say, oh, that looks so easy, and then you can't do it. So it's fun to learn that stuff, and you're always trying to expand your mind and learn more. It's not just about your body.
Very interesting.
Yeah, thank you.
Sensei Charles.
Well, my name is Charles Ahrens. I'm an Aikido instructor and still a student, of course. I started in, I don't know the month, but 1971 in Toronto. And I have been with Aikido ever since. I agree with a lot of what Chris, what you said.
About not killing us, right?
No, just about the...
no, not that part.
about the reasons, types of personalities that are attracted to a more traditional martial art. At the time that I started, the Bruce Lee thing was in the height of its craze. And I remember searching for martial art, probably for the same reasons that you did, Chris, that I found it fascinating. But as I searched the city of Toronto, I only recall seeing a lot of testosterone in these different dojos and people screaming and jumping and kicking off ladders. And it was very discouraging until a friend of mine introduced me to Aikido. And I was very drawn to the quietness and the grace, the fact that it's non-competitive, which, at least I think, I hope you agree with me, that all the traditional Japanese arts are, it's not for competition, it's not a sport. You can't put rules on what you can and cannot do, because the origin of these arts are survival. So, you know. So anyway, that's about it. I'm still going at it. I'm 66 years old, and I train 6 days a week, and fall over dead in the mat one day, maybe. Who knows?
Well, let's hope not. But would I be correct to assume that Aikido kind of has its origin in the samurai lineage of things?
Very definitely. The origin of Aikido goes back to Daito Jujutsu, which is a Takeda family art. Now, I'm getting out of my field of expertise here. I'm sure Chris knows a lot more than I do, but my impression is that a lot of the original arts were family controlled, or they tried to remain within. Did they try to remain within their families in this kind of issue?
Cause oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean to share your secrets with, you know, worth your life.
Well, wait a minute. Are we saying here that we have basically a samurai art and a ninja art in the same room? No, we're not going to go with Battle Royale. I'm just kidding, guys.
Well, no, the samurai were... they were warriors. They were servants to their daimyos. And I don't know anything, Chris, about shinobi or the related arts to it. And I don't know the relationships between the samurai and the shinobi. So hopefully you can... Yeah. I'm very interested in learning about that.
Well, as I take it, I'm no expert either, and I think my understanding of it certainly has changed from what I first learned, especially reading paperback novels in the 80s. but the whole ninja culture, we're talking about a long period of history, hundreds of years, and some people claim there were a counterculture of the samurai. I don't think that's entirely true. They were people living in a certain region of Japan, heavily mountain and forested region of Japan. Probably were falling more along the tenets of more indigenous religion in the areas, which was not as popular sometimes with the city or mainstream cultures at the time. They were trying to do their own thing. Some of them learned samurai traditions as well, as people abandoned the military life or they fled battles or whatever else and were seeking a place to live. Sometimes they settled in these places. And so a lot of our arts are quite formal samurai arts. They're well recognized. Well, they are definitely recognized within Japanese history as being known to exist. But then some of the other arts were a little more secretive and very much close family arts and very little of was shared outside of those groups until very, very recently.
So am I correct to say, because I've read that the ninjas, which a lot of people have compared it to kind of like the elite force of their time, almost like a special force in a way, kind of started out as monks and thieves. They were called the Yamabushi, I believe?
The Yamabushi were warrior priests, and there was definitely some relationship there. There's some that suggest that maybe more often than not, maybe some of those Yamabushi were actually ninja in disguise, because they were, certainly that was a big part of ninjutsu with the espionage part of it. And really, for an espionage agent, getting into combat is usually not considered the best thing to do, because you're kind of giving yourself away, and you have reached the end of your rope if you've been discovered and you have to fight. So there's a bunch of stuff in the ninjutsu schools that the grandmaster just doesn't even want to teach. He says it's out there. He says it's stuff about poisons and spycraft and geography and that sort of thing. He says there's no point in teaching that in the modern age. There's no purpose to that here. And he certainly doesn't want to be giving it out and the image that would give.
I can imagine too. Somebody could use that to very nefarious purposes, I guess. So they were the original Oriental spy in a way.
Yeah, certainly. I don't know if the original, but definitely they distilled a lot of what Sun Tzu talked about in his 13th chapter of The Art of War. That's pretty much what the ninja was about. More and more about gathering information and passing along and doing things samurai weren't allowed to do.
So I know that this is encompassing a huge period of Japanese history, but just as someone who knows very little about that history, I know that there was warring families and regions of land that they were sort of kept control over and fighting to maintain control. But how often would there have been wars? Like, was that a constant thing or once in a while? Or like, how often would a samurai actually have to go to battle?
It depends so much of the time. I mean, there was the Warring States period where, how long did that go for? It was like 112 years or something, I think. And that was a lot of work, for 3 years constant, much like medieval Europe, these were boys probably in their early teens going off at that point. They're already fully trained warriors going off to fight and stuff. And then there were other times, like after the Meiji Restoration, that it was a time of complete peace. Our image of the samurai walking around with the two swords and the silk kimono, that was a time of peace. And as one of my teachers said, the katana is a weapon of peace. It's kind of like the police officer wearing a pistol at his side. You go to war, you don't take you might take a pistol, but it's not your weapon. Your main weapon, is your rifle, the cannon, whatever else. Okay. That's warfare.
That's true.
So it's a very old art as compared to Aikido, which is much more recent as an art, isn't it?
The art, as it's called, Aikido, is certainly recent. Probably started in the early 1930s. But the body art behind it is goes back quite a long way.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a newer version of an old idea.
With different principles applied. The founder of the Ark became a deeply religious man as he grew older, and there's a lot of confusion, a lot of nonsense, unfortunately, attached to Aikido. But in its original form, it used to be Aikibujutsu, and it was very hard. Very injuries were common, and kind of only the tough survived. And like Chris said earlier, you had to be invited. The original people who were the students of the founder were high-ranking military people and so forth, but you couldn't just show up the dojo like you see in the movies and sit outside in the rain for 3 days and they accepted you. It was very closed. And
well, Jackie Chan made a whole career on that.
Yes, he did.
Oh, can I? Can we do our pop quiz now? Because I have a feeling some of these
questions
are going to be answered before we even get to the quiz. So.
You didn't tell me we had a pop quiz. What is it?
It's only four questions. No one knew. No one has been prepared.
Okay.
Yes, you guys know this music. It's whenever we have a quiz or a debate. And today, I guess we're putting the ninja versus the samurai. Am I playing in this too?
Yes, you are.
Oh, and versus the annoying guy behind the mic as well.
Okay, here we go. Everyone ready?
All ready.
About as ready as we'll ever be.
Just to clarify, as someone, I know very little about martial arts, so these questions might seem really incredibly obvious to you guys, but to myself and other people who might be listening who aren't all that familiar, they are not so obvious, so bear with me if this seems really trivial.
So should I use my...
What an incredibly stupid question.
Oh, thank you so very much. No. All right, first question. Then this is something you have both already touched on. In the 80s, all the popular culture kind of twisting of martial arts, so they're almost not recognizable. Which famous American practiced Aikido? Was it A, Chuck Norris, B, Steven Seagal, C, Bruce Lee, or D, Jackie Chan?
Not Steven Seagal.
Yeah, definitely Seagal. I'm just going to use the same answer.
This movie was great.
Steven Seagal has changed his name to Steven Marlon Brando. I mean, he's 400 pounds plus.
Oh, really? I haven't seen him for so long.
certainly not the person he was in the...
He's not in fighting form anymore, is what you're saying?
Made for sumo. Yeah, he has put on a lot of weight, he has.
Yeah.
We shouldn't be mocking him.
One would hope that does not impede his skill. He's still a very skilled
practitioner.
So.
He did boost the popularity of the art
for quite a while. He helped it quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny how the arts follow this, you know, certain movies come out and something new and it's the flavor of the decade.
We got the first question.
All three of you got that right. So, second question. Which of the following are not part of the 18 disciplines of ninjutsu, but may be taught alongside them? Is it A, free running and medicine, B, meteorology and geography, C, pyrotechnics and horsemanship, or D, espionage and tactics?
That's a trick question. I'm going to go with espionage and tactics because the rest of them seems like you said.
They're not part of the 18 disciplines of ninjutsu,
but they're taught alongside.
Or taijutsu, as it's called now, but taught alongside them.
I have to go with A.
Okay.
I don't know. I'll agree with Kevin. I'm hopelessly unknowledgeable about that.
And Chris is the one with the correct answer. It's A, free running and medicine.
Oh, no.
All the other things are part of the 18 disciplines, meteorology and geography.
Although, technically speaking, there's a tradition called the Matsutatra, which does involve some natural medicine ideas. It goes back, it's certainly linked with the Bujinkan and some of the other related arts.
I thought that was, when I was researching that, I thought that was really interesting that all these things, it's all essential survival skills, especially if you're by yourself and, you know, fleeing for your life or just trying to be undetected. Yeah, it's pretty neat.
And as Kevin will tell you, I do occasionally make my students run.
Yeah. Just got to make sure I get the right footwear next time.
Okay, next question. Aikido was created in the time period of A, 1910 to 1930. So this is the modern form of it. It has a long history, but this is the modern form as it's practiced. A, 1910 to 1930s. B, 1810 to the 1830s. C, 1650s. Or D, 1970s.
Okay.
Yeah. I've got to go with A.
Yes, we've already covered that answer, actually. Yes, it's it A. And this one, I'm not sure if I was reading a very accurate source, so hopefully I've got the question right. But Kane Doshi was, if I'm pronouncing that right.
Kane Doshi.
Doshi was a founder or someone involved in the founding of ninjutsu or the evolution of ninjutsu. He was A, monk, B, samurai, or C, farmer.
This is Doshu you're talking about? Doshu is just the leader of the way, I guess.
So then the name would be...
Kami, Kami the
okay.
Monk. Yeah.
Go with the monk? And you went with the...
Charles?
Well, I don't know. Do we have a Doshu? Do I assume all other Japanese traditional arts do or don't? Or?
Yeah, we're talking a long time ago here.
And Aikido Doshu means leader of the way. That's the headmaster of the art.
So, what were the choices? Monk?
Monk, samurai, or farmer?
I'm going to go with the farmer because you guys can go with the other one.
Actually, I'll think about it.
Don't change your answer,
yeah,
Chris.
Okay.
He was a monk, yes.
Okay. Oh, he was a monk. All right.
Like I said, I'm not sure how... This is a long time in the past, so how accurate that is, who knows. But that's what I read.
Did I actually get one question right on this, or I think I had them all wrong?
No, you got Steven Seagal and... You only got Ron Lauren, actually.
Oh, okay, that's not too bad. Awesome.
All right, well, thank you, gentlemen.
Now, let's get back into our thing, as we were talking about. You want to take a lead on the asking the questions about these gentlemen and the skeptical look at martial arts. Now that we've been done some intro and a bit of history.
Well, I have a question, or not really a question, but something that I'd like your opinion on. Quite a long time ago, my daughter was in kindergarten, and they did a field trip to a dojo, a karate dojo, and the instructor. He's a nice man. I don't remember his name now, but he was very, very militaristic and very strict. And he told them all, "You call me sir, and you do not question anything that I tell you to do." And I started thinking about that, and thinking about how respect is a huge part of any learning system, but also how in the past masters would have been well versed in poetry and in calligraphy, and they would have been very well-rounded individuals. It wasn't just fighting. And yet, in this particular dojo, and in others that I've seen in North America, that seems to get left out, and all that is focused on is the fighting, and especially if it's something where there's competitions. And so I'm curious what your impression of that is, and what you think it does to the art.
And Chris, why don't you handle this one?
I would agree with you, Karen. I think a large part of it is a lot of what we think of as modern martial arts is really largely a Western phenomenon, maybe extracted from arts taken, I guess, from Japan that were presented for high school students. Karate and judo are regular sports in high school in Japan, just like we would take soccer and baseball and football. And so they have a certain program that's much same as we teach, you know, kids in school. And so these are large groups of people, and especially if they're unruly teenagers, you know, you need to have that real structure to it. But that said, absolutely, respect was a huge part of certainly Japanese and most Eastern cultures. You know, it was a violent place. Life was cheap. And so, you know, you stepped outside those lines and you basically didn't follow your manners, and you're in a lot of trouble. Mm-hmm. So the whole culture works that way, and just being in Japan, you just see it's still much like that. They don't execute you for, you know, being insubordinate, but you know it's not overlooked like it would be here in the West so much. But yeah, I mean, I look to the classical martial arts, you know, and I think Aikido falls into that in the sense that it's heavily extracted from old Kobudo martial arts, and as is the Bujinkan arts, they come from Kobudo, although it's a relatively recent conglomeration. But our sensei, you know, he takes a break in the middle of class. We drink tea, and he does paintings, you know, and I think if you've mm-hmm. been to my place, you'll see that we have a couple of paintings around that he's given to me over the years. And he tells us one should not be just a martial artist. One should, that, you know, you shouldn't earn your living from martial arts. It says it makes you too narrow a person. You need to have an outside life. And then martial arts should give you a hone your edge.
Yeah, this question I wanted to get into, because you see exactly that. Karen kind of started on this, and you kind of pointed that out. You do see a lot of schools out there, and that's what they do for a living. These people do that for a living. You walk into the dojo, and all you see is trophies lying along the wall. And I don't know, I just get a really, really bad vibe about this whenever I walk in there. And is there really something to that? So you agree when you're saying, you know, one should not, although it'd be nice, but one should not really make a living as a martial arts teacher.
Yeah, I think I largely feel that. I mean, I understand where it comes from, and it's become a business now, you know, here. And so some people, it may be all they know, and I certainly know people in my art that go that way too, that they pretty much just teach all the time, every day. But I think there's more to life than that, you know. I think it's an important part of your life when you take it on, and, you know, it's going to stay with you, but I think you need to look outside a little bit. And you can draw on both to help you make you a better person. You know, I have a career quite well outside the dojo, and I think martial arts helps in my career, and I think my career helps me in my martial arts too.
Mm-hmm. Now, Karen, you brought up a point with your question. That part of your question was about children and the dojos, and you know, a lot of, I think, very few people enter martial arts. They probably really don't know what they want, but once they find out, you have very few lifers. Many people, I don't know, three quarters of my students over 45 years are it's a recreational event for them, and they come and they go. So as far as you mentioned something about discipline, gee, that's really an individual thing. I mean, I agree with Chris very strongly what he said about, you know, the Japanese dojos. In North America, you know, you find people that find a good balance, and you find people that are overly militaristic, like mm-hmm. this gentleman you were talking about. And at some point, you do have to, your teacher has put in a lot of time, he or she, and you do have to respect that.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't, it's probably not for you. You know, go mm-hmm. play soccer or do something else that you get your enjoyment out of.
Mm-hmm. I guess I totally agree with you what you say about they've earned your respect, and you need to respect your teacher. I guess that this person is not, like I said, I don't remember his name, and he was a very nice person outside of the class, but he was extremely militaristic inside the class, and I think that was what bothered me, was that aspect of the one thing that one aspect of the art, which would have been part of several different aspects, had been just become the only thing that he knew about or focused on. So that was the thing that concerned me.
Well, maybe that's the question we should be asking about this, is was teaching of martial arts, we see that in movies. We see that, you know, we were talking about Jackie Chan. That's what you see.
Mm-hmm.
The crazy old master that's got these really weird way of torturing you until you become this phenomenal. And people have this... sorry. There was a cow in my iPad. There, people have this idea that this is what you need to succeed. You need to have this really strict, unusual discipline. Is it really... How real is this? I mean, was it really like that in the past, or was it just?
It was very real hundreds of years ago. Your life depended on it. In modern art, it's Chiba Sensei, art teacher, has talked about this often, and Chris touched on it earlier. You know, you call yourself martial artists, you really aren't. You know, we're practitioners. At least our people are. I don't face life and death every day. And so it's very different.
Well, that means you know, you haven't been driving around Mission Abbotsford, have you?
Well, you know, Chris, have you ever read a book called Meditations on Violence?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So he talks about that, and other people have mentioned this. Training is different from sparring. Sparring is different from fighting. Fighting is different from actual combat. I mean, it escalates, and the mindset is completely different in either one. If you're in a job that requires life and death every day, police officers, correctional people, special forces, military people, and I really have no idea. I've never done that. So it's a very wide question, and it's kind of difficult to answer. I suppose it would have to deal with your circumstances.
So this is sort of connected to that. I mean, obviously, popular culture distorts everything that it looks at, pretty much, not just martial arts, but things like mixed martial arts.
Yes.
It actually takes the martial arts name
MMA,
and then puts it in a metal cage and puts these two people fighting each other. What do you think of something like that? How does that affect
I think Ferris Hinckley said...
is it helping or is it hurting martial arts?
Well, I mean, I guess it's, you know, it's a sense of help. I'm not a huge fan of the mixed martial arts myself, but I think, you know, it is keeping that lifeblood pumping a little bit, and you know, I think that's where the interest lies. I can certainly say over the last few years, I've seen a decrease in the number of new people interested in this style of martial art. There are some that come along, and sometimes people that come along and say, you know, I'm not interested in that. I say, well, why aren't you interested? Let's find out and talk about it and see. And sometimes we have something to offer those people.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all right there. But I think, you know, I don't know how really that falls on the true path of martial arts, in the sense that there's so much about it that really goes contrary to the real philosophy of the martial arts, you know. And
really?
And, you know, they're good fighters. You know, and there's no doubt those guys train hard. You know, they're good. I'm not saying anything about that. It's just that I think, you know, part of the idea of a martial artist is that you're trying to, you learn a lot about why you don't want to fight, really, with doing all this stuff. You learn about how you can damage
great
your body.
Point.
You know, we learn about knife fighting. The last thing, you know, I ever want to do is be in a knife fight. A knife fight would just be the ugliest thing imaginable. I mean, it's just, you know, horrible. And let alone, you know, breaking someone's arm or killing them or something. You know, that's not a pleasant place to really want to be. And I know, you know, I don't want to be there. So it's a real paradox, really, about what you study, you know, learning to do this and trying to make yourself a better person of learning these terrible things, I guess you could say.
Mm.
But I see the mixed martial arts thing is like, well, you know, we got tested out in the sea, and the whole idea of, well, if you can't really test it, you can't really do it, sort of thing. It's like, you know, I don't know. I don't buy that argument. These guys were training people to fight and kill hundreds of years ago, doing the same kind of methods we're using, that, you know, or using the same methods they are. They managed to learn, fight, and survive. I think it works. It's a different kind of thing. We just, you know, I just don't want to get in the ring and, you know, with the intention of I'm going to kill that guy. That's just ridiculous, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's just a different mindset. You know?
Yeah, Chris, I agree with you. I know nothing about MMA other than what the little bit I've seen. I don't know what their motivation is. I mean, these guys get paid, right? So it's a professional sport. As far as cross training, Karen, well, I'm not a big fan of that, and this is a very personal opinion. My thought on that, again, just to my own thoughts, it's hard enough to learn one discipline and to, you know, mix stuff up. I can't do it myself. I mean, there are probably very gifted people that can, but a lot of what my teacher says is that it's predicated on, a lot of martial art is predicated on the Japanese martial art, at least, is, you know, if you know how to do one thing really well, if that's all you ever learn, if you can execute that night and day in your sleep, you're very formidable. I mean, really, you don't have any openings, and I think that's kind of what it's about to me. And that's a lifelong study. I can't do it.
Could I compare this to somebody who speaks 5 different languages? They'll speak one very, very well, but they'll speak passably okay with the other 4.
No, there are people that are extremely gifted in it, and there are people that cross-train very successfully. Miyamoto Musashi says, you know something of everything, so I can't do that. I'm just a dumb guy. It takes long enough to... I've heard it, again, our teachers say that it takes 40 to 50 years just to learn your body, you know, what it is and what it does. And
I think you have to look at the theme that goes through a martial art tradition too, right? So, you know, when we do a lot of different weapons, and you couldn't simply say, now we're learning spear technique, or now we're learning staff technique, now we're learning knife technique. There has to be a flow of the body movement, the mechanics that are, you know, and every once in a while they students say, well, couldn't you just do this? Yes, you could do that. And it may even work. But honestly, it means you have to learn a new thing to do. You know, it's a new way of moving. Let's try and keep it consistent in a pattern that works. You know, that's certainly a key thing. So, yeah, you can try and, you know, cover your holes you have in your training and say, okay, well, I'm a really good striker. I know to kick and punch, but my ground game is no good. So I'm going to go study judo for a while, or I'm going to study Brazilian jiu-jitsu. And, you know, but how does your movement in Brazilian jiu-jitsu really work with your karate? I mean, do you have that inconsistent movement pattern, or you know, how do you do that? It's possible. You can do it, but it's not going to be an art anymore.
Well, isn't that exactly what kind of Bruce Lee sort of did when he invented Jeet Kune Do?
Bruce Lee is one of those special individuals.
Oh, yeah. Special is...
There are some... I mean, he was truly an amazing martial artist, there's no doubt. And there are several of those around, you know, but they're not most of us.
Mm-hmm. So do you find, like, going back to, like, Bruce Lee or Jackie Chan or MMA, do you find that students come to you with... expectations that they will very quickly be able to do those sorts of things?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Neo, I know jiu-jitsu.
Welcome to the Matrix.
Yeah, and, you know, or there's, you know, the five-minute training montage, you know, we talked about this, you know,
yes.
Your montage, like, no, it's coming every day, training the rest of your life, you know, over and over, and, you know, the sore muscles and the bruises and, you know, the strains and just the tiredness, you know, the mental fatigue, the emotional fatigue, I really don't want to do this anymore, and keep them coming back and coming back. You know, and working on what you suck at. That's, you know, the real part. Like, everyone likes to work on what's strong. Oh, I'm punch hard. Okay, I'll work on my punches. Well, you punch well or well enough, you know, but you can't kick. You know, you need to work on that. Your flexibility is poor. So, you know, training's hard. It's like everyone wants to learn a new language, right? Everyone says, oh, I want to speak that other language. But who actually sits down and does the work to learn that language?
See how he said your flexibility is poor and looked at me when he said that? Right away, he knew.
Have you ever run into people, Chris, that will come to your dojo and you'll be showing them a real core piece of your art, I mean, a foundational piece, and they'll say something like, you know, well, I don't like that, or I don't want to do that. And my response is to say, what are you talking about? You know, like, this doesn't, you know, you don't like this part? This is, it worked for warriors. I mean, what, you don't even know what you're talking about. So how can you...
Yeah.
How can you say you don't like this?
Well, you might prefer being punched in the face.
Yeah. What did Mike Tyson say? It's something like something to the effect that you can be great boxer until you get punched in the face, and then what do you do, or something like that.
Yeah.
I have an experience of people saying, there's a few things. I mean, probably like you guys, we do a lot of Akemi. So we have a lot of, you know, learning to hit the ground properly, rolling and break falls and stuff like that. And most people that come to us, you know, if they're even if they're as young as their teens, using, you know, 20s, 30s to come in, they haven't been rolling on the ground since they were 8 years old. And some of them find that challenging. And in fact, sometimes if you have people that show up at the dojo, you just recognize, you know, not sure I really want this guy training and hear us. We can just practice with Kemi all day long, and they just disappear. It's interesting how it works. And the guys have been with us for, you know, 10 years. They have no problem. They understand. Okay, we're doing a Kemi today.
I got a couple of questions. I wanted to ask, a lot of time when you look at martial art, the first thing that people start going, they start talking about energy flow. They call it chi or ki or something like that. How much truth is there to that, if any?
It's very true.
You think it's very true?
Oh, I can say without question, but it's... In the United States, there's a state called Missouri, and they have a saying there that says, show me, I'm from Missouri. And I've always interpreted that as, if you can feel it, touch it, hold it, toss it up and down, and it's real, and if it's not, then it's not. I just don't buy into that. And again, I don't have the knowledge of it as far as thousands of years of culture behind me like they do in the East, but if you're asking, is internal energy real? Yeah, sure. I'm not adept at describing it really well. I don't think I can, but it's real. It's something you can feel. You can experience it with a senior teacher, very much so.
Yeah, because there's some pretty far out things there. I mean, I remember watching a video they were talking about. I think it was a Kung Fu Master, Sifu Chen, something like that. He was apparently extinguishing candles at 10 feet away with a punch in the air. He's 10 feet away, and I don't know. Seems like
that's a different thing, though.
There's a lot of charlatan stuff, too. Yeah, parlor tricks and martial arts. That's been around for hundreds of years, you know, people doing things and, you know, bending spears at their throat, their shirt stuff. And,
yeah, but a bit more like the Shaolins are doing.
Yeah,
they're doing tours to pick up money to do that kind of stuff. But you think there is something, Charles? You think there is something that might be worth exploring?
Absolutely, it's at the heart of it. Eastern cultures grow up with this belief system embedded deeply, hundreds and hundreds of years. It's not a thing they even think about. It's like breathing. You know, it's there. Is it hard to do? It is for me. It comes and goes. It's as you get older and you learn your body, it's there. It's very elusive. At least those are my experiences with it. But Chris, what do you, can you jump in on this?
Kevin knows a little of my thoughts on this. As I say straight off, I don't believe in magic. I don't think that's real. I think there's something there is a spirituality to proper practice of martial art. We have a test that, certainly could be taken that way as being showing that you're receptive to this, and I think it's pretty good. But I have my own ideas sometimes about things, and certainly there's many practitioners in my art would, maybe disagree with some of my feelings about it. I tend to look at the idea of ki as more about intention, body structure, your state of mind, that sort of thing. Whether the act of energy. I haven't seen evidence for that, but I will say there's things I don't know. I've seen things that have been interesting. I don't know if I can explain that. And that's, from my fairly scientific point of view or reasoning. But I'm willing to accept that there are things I don't understand. And I just don't like the science say, aha, I can't explain it. It must be magic. I really dislike that idea. But it doesn't mean I'm going to sit down and investigate it myself, but sometimes I might play with these ideas a little bit.
Something that I've played hockey a lot, and this sounds really strange, but there are days when you play and suddenly there's nothing except for what you're doing right there, and it's almost like a physical meditation. Nothing exists outside the world except for what you are doing with your body right at that moment. And I would think that in martial arts, when you practice, you would get to the point where you could sort of feel that quite a bit. So is that something that might tie in with this concept? It's more like it's a meditation, but it's a very physical sort of ability to do
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely, I've always said that training for me it is a standing meditation, right? So we bow in being a class, and for me that's it's a ritual. And then we wanted to talk a little about mysticism, but I think mysticism, that's definitely has mystic properties to it, that you have a ritual, there's a liturgy, there's a thing that we say, it's Japanese, that basically says class is starting. For me that says, that puts me, after years of doing this, it gets me in that mind frame. And then when we train, that is meditation, absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's trying to put your mind in that right point to be receptive, be aware, and let it's almost like a super consciousness that things are happening around you, and maybe it's freeing your body to do things without the fetters of your mind interrupting it. But
Sensei Charles is a great saying for that. You call it the beginner's mind. Always
well,
has the beginner's mind.
That's very standard in Japanese art. And I want to touch on this again because it's important to me.
Of course.
This the key is something that you can watch on a YouTube video or something. I mean, that's no. And watching a lot of our founders' earlier footage looks fake. When you talk about key, my interpretation of it is a centered body. And I think any martial student after 2, 3, 4 decades, whatever, you know when your body is centered. I know when I go to my teacher, he can't point his finger at me, and I don't do backflips or anything like that. But if I try to move him, for example, I can't do it. There's no magic to it, but just learning how to center your body, where the center is, that's, if you want to talk about ki, that's it for me. The concept goes back thousands of years. I mean, to India, what's the word, prana? No, that's breath. Everyone has this center of your body. And I can't imagine that the North American culture, which is, I mean, these people, at least in Japan, thousands of years ago, and in India and China, I mean, we were crawling around in loincloths or sheepskins while they had mathematics and geography. And so I just find it kind of ridiculous that people interpret ki or chi or as something that you can, again, make people do flips or burst into flames or whatever the heck they do. I don't know.
Yeah, is it? That's exactly my point. I can understand saying you can center your body, you can concentrate, you can be focused. That's fine. But when it reaches the realm of outside the laws of physics, they'll say, this guy is so rigid, he's so focused, he's so centered that you cannot physically bend his arm. That to me is a bit. It's almost marketing. It sounds like marketing to at that point.
That's to me too.
Okay.
So you're what you're asking is about the, like how the things that you see on YouTube or whatever.
Yellow bamboo.
I've never seen that. I really need to pull that up.
Everyone listening now, just go Google yellow bamboo and look for a video.
On YouTube, yellow bamboo. I'll look that up for sure.
So yeah. So that's you guys are, it sounds like you both agree that that's kind of the sham part of it, that these things aren't real, but people are just marketing them.
Well, I think these are people that have believed their own delusion or their own lies, that they've gone this way, that, and it falls into, I guess, a bit of a cult pattern, really, because when people start to, there's no way it can work without the students allowing the teacher to do these things,
so
this is where they fail, and they say, "Hey, look, I'll do it. I'll throw out a challenge. Any mixed martial arts want to come in here, I'll use my ability to throw ki, and you won't be able to defeat me." And they get handed their ass, they can't figure it out. And I think it's because they've gone to this point that they say they believe their own lies, that and they've become deluded. And it is mental illness, I think, and that's unfortunately gives a bad name to martial arts in general, because that's not what we're really about, right?
Yeah, I agree with you. Your teacher Hatsune Vicente, this is an interesting different side of this. You talk about belief systems or your perception. If you were ignorant and you looked at him, I've seen his work, and he's an amazing martial practitioner. If you walk up to someone like that and you have no perception, it's a regular person.
Dresses very oddly, but yes.
Well, dresses oddly, but I mean, if you have, if you're sensitive to this, there are certain people that you would not, for example, come over with and take a swing at. You just—it's like watching a tiger that's sleeping. It looks like a big pussycat until it gets angry. And I know in our discipline, people have come over to Shiva Sensei, and walked right into him, and
yeah, I understand that because I did meet Chiba Sensei once, and it's exactly the feeling I had. I really felt like this guy stepped out of a time warp. I could have put a samurai armor on him, and it would have been believable. He really had that that presence.
Yeah, he has presence and intensity, and those. If you're sensitive to that, then you stay away from it. So that's another interesting side of it to me, is that,
right.
You know, I think we've kind of revolved around this magical part of it, and I agree that that's nonsense, but I would never come over to... There are people that you get in a mat or you're at a seminar, they see people that you've never met from Japan or something, you feel they've got the juice.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so that's key to me. That's what we're talking about.
That's very interesting. That's very interesting. And almost warrants another show to look deeper into this, because it seems like we've already just scratched the surface,
mm-hmm.
and we're just about 5 minutes shy of an hour already.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I know. So, shall we move on then?
Mm-hmm.
We'll have to come on. Let's do another segment.
Well, that was very interesting. Thank you for your thoughts on that.
Another brilliant moment brought to you by religion.
And again, feel free to jump in if you have anything to say.
Yeah, feel free to jump in, guys. Now, this is our wacky news in religion, as usual. And bear with me for a minute here, but you're going to see where this is going. There's a gentleman called Gordon Klingenschmidt, who wins the GOP primary in Colorado.
Republican primary, for those of you who don't know.
The GOP stands for Grand Old Party. Now, I know some of you are saying, Kev, why are you talking about this? These are American politics. Why are we talking about this? Well, bear with me here for a second. This gentleman is apparently a disgraced former Navy chaplain who claimed to have successfully exorcised a lesbian soldier. And he won by 52.6% of the vote. So let that sink in for a second. This is a guy who basically says Obamacare causes cancer, that people need guns to defend against left-wing crazies, the FCC allows demons to visually rape kids, that gays should be discriminated against since only heaven-bound people are entitled to equal treatment, gays are inhuman, they should print anti-gay Bible verses on gay wedding photos. This is a politician. And he says that gay soldiers are constantly taking breaks to change their diapers because their sin causes them to lose their bowels.
Okay, let me just say that he got elected as, within the Republican Party, this is not the general American population, right?
No,
This is a very small fraction of a very small fraction of American population in one state. I can't remember which state you said it was.
Colorado. Now, I know, like I said, people are saying, what's the link here? And my first question was, could this happen in Canada? Can we get this kind of crazy politician?
Well, no.
You would think so. But then go see Peter McKay. Peter McKay has appointed 13 judges, and 12 of them are men, one of them is a woman. 34% of the judges appointed by the Conservatives are women. And this is a gentleman that is a staunch creationist, and he's a staunch believer that the Earth is 6,000 years old and the traditional roles of men and women.
Okay, so that's 34% of conservative judges that have been appointed in the past.
Judges appointed by conservatives.
34%, but he has done 1 in 12.
1 in 13.
1 in 13, so.
So when he was asked why, he made comments about women not wanting to travel away from their kids. I don't know about you, but that starts to raise a red flag as far as I'm concerned. And then he had the famous Mother's Day and Father's Day greetings, where he basically, on the Mother's Day greeting, he praised the ability to juggle the work and family. And then on the Father's Day, he basically praised men for their ability to shape the minds of future leaders. Then he claims it's apparently a female staffer that did that.
Well, he caught heat for this because it was sexist, and then instead of owning up for it, he said, oh, well, I had a woman write that.
Yeah.
So that was his defense.
Question one is, first of all, is anybody surprised by this? And question two, although this is a lesser degree than this Gordon Klingenschmidt in the States, I'm starting to see the same pattern. It's not as bad as down there, but this is how it begins. Our politician doing that. You guys have any thoughts on this? Or am I just nuts here?
No, you're not nuts. you could spend years talking about, you know, this kind of issue as far as Peter McKay. You know, one thing I will say about this, and I'll leave it alone, is that one of my students was in the military, and he says the first thing that military people do is deny when there's a problem, and then when that doesn't work, they blame somebody else. And so that's universal. I mean, you just had in Japan a couple weeks ago, there was a member of parliament, a woman, who was pushing for home care, and she was hounded unmercifully in the Diet to the point of tears, where her fellow colleagues, which were men, were basically saying, you know, breed, don't lead, I guess, is a way.
Oh, we're not babies.
Yeah. Ouch.
So
breed, don't lead?
Yeah, well, I mean, so horrible. All I'm saying or alluding to is that this concept of you know, it's not indigenous, or it's not exclusive to the United States or Canada. I mean, they're good people, and there are way out people everywhere.
Yeah, but I guess one of the point I'm trying to make here is I find it scary, although Canada is a much more secular country than our neighbors at the south, I find it scary when I'm seeing the people in power right now turning more and more toward these kind of things. And Peter McKay is just one of them. The Prime Minister is a fairly religious fellow. The Minister of Science, his last name is Goodyear, doesn't even want to pronounce himself on religion. The MP, Ed Fast, for Abbotsford, said to a friend of mine during an interview, and without missing a beat, that he thought the Conservatives were doing the work of God. I don't know. I'm seeing a whole bunch of red flags here. I get some people saying, "Oh, Kevin, come on, you're just..."
Well, no, religion and politics shouldn't mix. I mean,
yeah, it's a huge red flag, and you're seeing it here in Canada. It's coming across, and it's seeping across the board.
I mean, the funny thing is that the states actually, you know, they have a written in division between church and state. In Canada, we really don't.
No.
And while I don't agree with these individuals, I think that, you know, the idea of the core of the religion is that, you know, you're trying to follow good values, you know, you think what are good values, and so I can see how if you believe you're following good values, why would you not pursue those in your job, which for them is, you know, being leaders. So at least, you know, they're honest and upfront about what they're talking about, and I guess it falls upon the population to say whether you want that or not, you know, who you're voting for.
That's a great point.
Yeah, and to that point, in Canada, so Peter McKay says these things, which are, as you said, much less horrible than the things his American counterpart said. And in Canada, there's an outcry. There is lots of people have been jumped down his throat about him saying these things, whereas in the States, you actually have to say you're religious to get elected. Like it's a very different thing. In Canada, people say, "No, look, you said that, and that was wrong," and there's an outcry. And in the States, it doesn't seem to happen that much. So, I think.
But you know, I'm still sorry. I don't want to break the point, but we were all raised with the idea. I don't know about you guys, but my dad always used to say, "The United States sneezes, Canada gets a cold." You know, so I a lot of the things that happen in the States first, and then they happen down here. And this is what I'm worried about. This is what I'm worried about, because I see the writing on the wall out there. It is going nuts, just like the whole Hobby Lobby thing that just happened last week. It's going crazy down there, and it seems to be spreading this way, coming up north. It's not nowhere near as bad, but it is, in my opinion, starting to come over.
I don't necessarily agree with that, Kevin. I mean, we're a fundamentally different culture than the U.S., thank goodness. And I can't see it happen. I sure wouldn't want to see it happen.
Well, you don't want Canada to turn like the U.S.?
No. I, what did Rick Mercer say? We're bigger and we're on top, so that makes U.S. our bitch.
Love Rick Mercer. Well, I think your reaction to like Peter McKay... People, there's been an outcry about that. I think that tells you that Canada is not going to accept these sorts of things.
Well, we should certainly hope so, and let's hope people stay on top of something like that, and they get involved as well. Something like that will seep by if people are too apathetic about it.
Well, on that, there's two by-elections, two in Alberta, two in Ontario. I believe the voter turnout in Alberta anyway was 15%, 1-5. That is absolutely appalling.
Yes,
so.
That is disgraceful.
Wow.
Nothing else to add on that? Let's move on?
Yes.
Okay, let's move on. Time for my rant, I guess. I was once told by an acquaintance that she didn't like skeptics because they ruined the magic of living. Although I was taken aback by an answer I wasn't expecting, I have to now plead guilty to the charges. But is that such a crime? We all have a natural tendency to admire what we perceive as beauty, art, poetry, and the like. They give us hope that our already difficult life can be improved and we aren't doomed to misery all too common in this pale blue dot. From the immortal works of Shakespeare to the masterpiece of Rodin or Tchaikovsky, humans have dedicated space, time, and even bonded to culture this pursuit of hope through the admiration of beauty and the magic of life. It has only enriched our species. But like every successful invention, there are usually cheap knockoffs that appear shortly after, trying to ride this wave of success. We're all aware of cheap imitation of Gucci bags or iPhones, to name a few, but we often ignore the stories and myths that are a pale imitation of life and whose only purpose is to either curb your habits or steal your energy and money. Why do we skeptically look at urban myth but accept religious stories because they seem to bring magic to your life? These myths are so persistent that they've infiltrated everything in culture, just like we saw in Martial Arts Tonight. The bottom line is simple. Do you prefer a possibly harsh truth or would you rather have a comfortable lie? Reality or virtual? Skepticism isn't just important in the pursuit of truth, it's vital. We certainly aren't doing ourselves any favor by living in a made-up world filled with magic beings, angels, monsters, and gods, and the blood-drenched pages of history books testify to the folly of our willingness to accept faith as a reasonable gauge of reality. It's high time to teach ourselves and our kids not what to think, but how to think. I guarantee there will be no less fantastic or awe in the life with a healthy dose of skepticism, but as Henry Kissinger once said, it has the added value of being true. Well, brings us to the end of our show.
Thank you, gentlemen, so much for joining us. That was wonderful to have you here.
You're welcome.
Yeah, it was great to have both of you guys. Let's give them a large applause to these people. Sensei Charles and Sensei Chris. Hopefully you guys will get a lot of sponsors. Hopefully you guys will welcome back anytime you want.
It'll be fun to come back again.
Yeah, it would be fun to come back again. Chris, I greatly admire your very deep knowledge of the hopological guy here. You know what hopology is?
No.
Foot warfare.
Look it up.
Okay. So we're not going to have a fight between those two eventually.
Of course not. They are both gentlemen and scholars.
Oh, jeez. I was so hoping for a battle here. No, I guess not.
No, I don't think you were.
No, I'm kidding. So anything coming up on the next couple of shows, Karen, you want to mention? Or?
Next show, I believe we are going to have Mr. Mark Cunningham join us.
Yes.
With a look at raising your family as an atheist.
Yeah.
And
We'll have that, and we have Peter Boghossian that's scheduled to apparently come talk to us, probably live via somewhere in Portland, somewhere in September, and Dr. Del Rey is going to be talking to us as well about the God virus. So, guys, we'll see you guys in a couple weeks. Until then, have a great day.
Bye.
Thank you, guys.
Bye. Mm-hmm.